Right. I'd like to welcome you all to this special event for a Monday afternoon. We're here because, you know, we're in a very difficult time for journalism in the United States and in fact, in the world. Journalists, as we know from reading the newspaper, put their lives on the line every day in order to help us discover what's going on in the world, what's important. They let us know what the facts are in the world so that we can make our own determinations about things like how we'll vote, how we'll live our lives, who we are, who our societies are, and how we'll all move forward together. And in the United States, there is no better journalism organization, as far as I'm concerned. We may be a little prejudiced because at KRCB we are NPR and PBS affiliates, and we believe in public media and the fact that we don't have to have a commercial in the middle of our news to let you know who is paying the freight. We're doing it because you, each and every one of you, help support this work, and we thank you for that. And so when we found out that we had the opportunity to have one of the key people at NPR come and visit us today, we jumped at that chance. Elizabeth Jensen is the ombudsman, and they're not trying to make you an ombudsperson or anything. You'll be an ombudsman.
I prefer public editor.
All right. Elizabeth Jensen is the public editor at National Public Radio, and in that role she serves as the public's representative, as your representative to NPR, to helping to bring transparency to matters of journalism and journalism ethics. And you don't just get this kind of job, out of the blue. She was a contributor to the New York Times covering public broadcasting. She's written for Columbia Journalism Review and Current, which is public broadcasting's trade publications, has reported on the media for the LA Times, was a senior writer for Brill's Content, which was a fascinating, we'll have to have that discussion another time, fascinating publication. Spent 6 years at the Wall Street Journal, where she won awards, as well as time in New York Daily News. And here's a conversation you might have with her on the side. When she's not covering media, she teaches food journalism at NYU, so we want to know more about that for sure, and has occasionally reported on the food world, including investigating vegetarian marshmallow fraud. And again, when it comes time for the question and answer section, forget to ask about vegetarian marshmallow fraud. I think the bones are still in there. I think that's what she may tell us. Anyway, Elizabeth Jensen, thank you so much for coming to Sonoma County. All right, let me then have Alex Chadwick join us. He's an American journalist who may be best known. I'm going to have to read part of your Wikipedia entry, although there's lots of other ways to introduce Alex. But probably best known for his work at National Public Radio. Those of us who have spent time working at NPR at any time in the last decades knew about Alex's work and know about Alex's work. He was the person who, when someone said, "How do you learn how to write for radio?" the answer was usually, "Listen to Alex Chadwick." He was the one, as NPR was discovering exactly what it was, what it was going to be, how it would become part of American life, and what radio news would be following the sort of the straight-ahead model after of CBS and BBC, that we had those models, but we didn't really have an expansive model of how we listen to the world, make that into news, and then bring it to the public every day. And Alex was one of the people to help figure that out in his time at National Public Radio. Part of the development of Morning Edition, had his own show, so day to day for a while, worked also at ABC and CBS, received numerous awards, and thank you for joining us, Alex.
You're welcome.
And Paul Gullickson was, up until so very recently, the editorial director and columnist for the Santa Rosa Press Democrat for 20 years, where he managed the newspaper's editorial and opinion section. And during the firestorm last year, wrote numerous columns and editorials and was part of the team that was honored with an award that we as a community feel that we are part of, although we didn't earn it. It was Paul and his group that earned it as the Pulitzer Prize for the Santa Rosa Press Democrat for helping us cope and deal with the fires. And before that, he was Peninsula Bureau Chief for the Chronicle, editor of the Palo Alto Weekly, editorial page editor of the Peninsula Times. And in his current job, Paul oversees the strategic communications media, social media, and graphic design for Sonoma State University, and helping tell the story of this great institution to the community. So please welcome all three of our guests here today. All right, Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you for having me. These events we've been doing around the country for pretty much the past year and a half. We developed them, actually my office developed them as a way to expand the output, input into the ombudsman office. So as Steve explained, my role is basically as the liaison between the public and the newsroom. So I have no management role, I don't speak for NPR, I am an NPR employee, I report to the CEO. The newsroom can't tell me what to do. I can tell them what to do, but they can take my advice or not. So I write a weekly column in which I try to argue sort of for the listeners and changes and that I really think need to be made. And they often listen to my advice. Sometimes they don't. We'll talk about some of those issues today. So we've been doing these events around the country. To really explain sort of how the journalism works at NPR, how the decision making works. Part of the goal is to really help listeners and readers of NPR.org understand that there is a decision making process behind the news you hear on the air. So we've started, so let me start here actually. We've explained sort of what the ombudsman does. A lot of the input comes in the form of emails. So we get, I think those are the figures there for the last 3 months. We got 1,500 emails, roughly, answered 1,500 emails. The main topic we get, we label them all, the main topic is political bias, both right and left. We also hear about language. It's no surprise that NPR listeners are very, very concerned about the very specific words that NPR uses on the air. So we get a lot of those complaints. Kessler interview, that is an interview that we did with a person, a white supremacist. It was a controversial interview. We can talk about that later if you'd like. We did hear about the Kavanaugh-Ford hearings, and then a perennial complaint is too much Trump. So that just gives you a little view of what we do. So what we do in these events is we have some scenarios, sort of just to get the conversation flowing. And so I'm going to just read it off there. You can see it, and we're going to ask you to raise your hands. So the first one we do just to get things kicked off is, should journalists vote? So I'm curious, how many of you believe, yes, it's a fundamental right and responsibility of all citizens? Just because you're a reporter, that does not mean you give up that right. Okay, two, in order to keep their reporting focused on fairly representing the perspectives of all sides, reporters should not be choosing a favorite even in a voting booth. No. Okay. Yes. Every journalist vote. Should journalists vote? Yeah, so journalists are citizens, of course, but should a journalist vote? Mm-hmm. So it may or may not surprise you, I don't know, that a lot of the political journalists I know do not vote. They just think that will sort of, two things. One, that will sort of, in some ways, inform, taint, hurt their coverage. They want to stay just completely independent. And two, if you live in a state like New York, where I live, my office is in DC, but I live in New York, you have to register for a political party if you want to vote in a primary. And that information, of course, is public. So sometimes there are real conflicts of interest in journalism we like to talk about, and sometimes there are perceived conflicts of interest. So if you're registered as a Republican and someone goes and looks it up and doesn't like your coverage and thinks your coverage is biased towards Republicans, they're going to make that leap. And so some journalists just don't like to even give anyone sort of perception at all. So I'm just curious if either of you has an opinion. Did you vote? And do you have a feeling on those issues?
Sorry, say that again.
Did you vote? Do you vote? Did you vote when
I
you
do
were
vote.
Covering?
Mm-hmm. I do vote.
Mm-hmm. Did you know people who don't vote?
I vote because I'm a citizen, and uh-huh. I think it's my responsibility to vote.
Uh-huh. And you didn't worry about it hurting your coverage? Or?
Yeah, I don't think it has yet.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I vote. I think it's our responsibility to vote. Mm-hmm. But I do respect the barriers that these kinds of guidelines try to create, the separation. Right. Because I think as journalists, and I'm speaking as a former journalist who spent 35 years in the business, there is a real concern to want to impart to the public that you are covering your things impartially and that you are not taking sides.
Right.
And I think that the registration is really the bigger issue, mm-hmm. because, you know, if you've been, I've had people attack me based on my registration. Although my particular registration, when I was younger, I thought if I mixed it up, then they would never know what party I really belonged to. And so I have sort of a checkered career of my registration personally, but
going back and forth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I think that was more of an accident where I was living at the time more than anything. But I do think I do know of people who are very, we've had that debate in newsrooms before. And just on that note, at the Press Democrat, we had very strong guidelines, principles on, we could not, even though we were certainly allowed to vote, it's a freedom of speech issue, we could not take part in political rallies, for example, right. parades. We could not engage in particular causes, could not be, you know, actively involved in any way. And so I could not, and as editorial director, I could not serve on any boards or anything mm-hmm. like that. So, and again, make it clear that we want to be impartial.
Right. NPR has those, right. Absolutely. Yeah. NPR has those rules as well. And there's an ethics code that's online at npr.org that lays out all of the restrictions, and some of the journalists chafe at them, but... for the most part, I find it a pretty well-reasoned code. Okay, let's get into some of the meatier issues that we have been dealing with in the newsroom. So, the President of the United States reportedly used vulgar language during a closed-door meeting. I think we all remember that. Should NPR air the phrase that he used? No, it's offensive to many listeners, and reporters can convey the meaning without using the actual word. Anyone believe that? Ah. Okay. Yes, but bleep it. And yes, it's important to tell the story accurately. Use it in its entirety and issue a language advisory at the beginning of the story. Okay, that seems to be the most people in the room. So we all remember this happened back in, I think, January. I won't repeat the word here. NPR, the first night, I think it broke sort of midday, late afternoon, actually, NPR did not use the word on the air. They specifically sort of avoided it, and it was very clear that they were avoiding using it. So Twitter that night, I don't know how many of you are Twitter users, but the NPR audience decided that NPR was not using the word out of cowardice. So this whole narrative developed that NPR was avoiding it because they didn't want to offend the president, and alternatively, that they were worried about FCC. So the FCC regulations don't count because you are allowed to use objectionable language if it's in the context of a news report. You can't use it as an utterance, but you can use it when you are covering a news report where someone says that. So that was actually not true. But so then I came in the next morning and I was really curious, why did NPR not use the word? Because at 7 a.m. the next morning, the standards editor weighed in and said, no, actually, NPR should use the word. And so the first night they weren't using the word, and then at 7 a.m. onward, they were using it. And some listeners kind of joked that actually people were gleefully using the word. Scott Simon, I think, said that on the air at one point. Oh, I'm going to say a word that I'll never be able to say again. So I was curious about that switch. And so I asked the deputy managing editor on duty why he had chosen, I think it was a Thursday night, not to use the word. And his response, I thought, was very interesting. He said that he thought that if NPR used the word, which is exactly what happened, it would take the focus off the actual substance of the president's comments. So the comments were interpreted by many as to be extremely racist. So he was worried that regardless of how you interpreted the remarks, that it would that the focus on the word itself and the language would remove the focus on the content of what the president had allegedly actually said. That was actually one of my favorite columns that I did, because it's sort of, there's this public narrative that goes on about why people do things, and actually when I investigated it, had, you know, the actual reasoning had nothing to do with sort of what everyone was speculating. So anything you all want to add?
Well, I'll go first this time. The term he referred to, if you remember, he called a certain country a shithole country. And we decided as a newspaper to sort of edit the comment. And we wrote in our editorial, it was S-H-O-L-E. That's how we did it as a paper. And it had nothing to do, we felt ultimately, there was no secret about what words he chose by the time we came out. And there was no secret, even by looking, if that was your only information, you could pretty quickly ascertain what it was he said. And so the decision on whether or not to run the term was less a reflection of the president, which was the discussion itself, but more a reflection of us and our principles and our standards. And we felt we're a family, you know, mm-hmm. newspaper, a community newspaper, and we have certain standards on what language we want, and we felt breaking them for the president was not the right thing to do. And I mean, in some ways, by bleeping the president as we did, it actually felt drew more attention to how out of the norm this was. I can't remember the last time we bleeped a president. Hmm. And so it sort of put that sort of a focus on it. Now, that's not to say we didn't have huge internal debate.
Yes.
And ultimately, right. The newsroom used the word in another context, and we used it in one of our columns. So it was a little bit, you know, we were a little bit pregnant on this one. Mm. And it typifies where we are with this president. He is taking us, pushing us, dragging us into new territory that we often feel uncomfortable because it's challenged us, our ethics, in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And this being a good example.
Mm-hmm. Alex, did you want to add anything?
I think it would be correct to play that recording.
Yes.
It
wasn't
because there's a vileness to it that uh-huh. I think is very expressive of the man, mm-hmm. almost an anger in it that expresses this person who is in this vast position of authority mm-hmm. and acting rather carelessly.
Mm-hmm. Let's go on to the third one. Now, this is probably the biggest issue, I think, that NPR has had to deal with in many different iterations in the past couple years. And that is this just flood of misinformation and inaccurate statements, and some would call them lies, that we've seen. So NPR has sort of gone through a process of trying to figure out how to deal with them. You don't want to alienate people. You want people to hear you. We can talk about lies, I think, a little bit. But so here's a scenario. So the president makes a statement during a campaign rally that is not true. You are producing a piece for AIR that contains that tape. Do you air it in its entirety? He is the president, after all, and you can't change his words. So do you air the quote? Oh, does anyone believe that? Okay, do you air the quote, but with couched language, say that there is no evidence to back up that claim? Okay, that seems to be most people in the room. All right, the third option is don't air that clip at all. It's wrong. No one's voting for that. Okay, so in the emails to my office, we get a flood every time we air a clip from a campaign rally. that has inaccurate information in it, we get a flood of emails from people saying, don't air it, it's wrong. And if you hear it on the air, you're going to start to believe it or internalize it. NPR's general choice is option number two. They do air it, but they say very clearly that there's no evidence to back up that claim. You know, it's a tricky issue. I sort of waver in my own personal opinion between option two and option three. I think you absolutely, if you are going to air it, of course, you have to make clear when something is accurate or inaccurate. Not airing it, it's wrong. I think it's important to hear what our elected officials are saying. You know, any elected official, any president, I think we've always covered presidents and what they say. And so I think it's actually important to hear those words and hear them as they are being uttered. I understand the argument that you don't want to keep repeating something that is inaccurate. So any thoughts up there?
This came up when the New York Times made the decision that they were going to start referring to the president's misstatements and half-truths as lies. That was a seminal moment in our coverage of this presidency. And I know there are a number of papers that still refrain from referring them as lies.
Including NPR.
Because, right, and because lies certainly connote a certain intention as to what your willful attempt to deceive. But there's certainly no getting past that we are past that Rubicon. I mean, we are clearly in a realm where our president is deceiving, is trying to cast himself in a different light at every turn. And so it's very challenging to cover that when your objective is to tell the truth. And that is every journalist's objective. And so to do that without referring to what the president or somebody else says as half truth or a truth, I think is really hard. So I commend our journalists today who have become more upfront about this and being very clear. You see much more fact checking going on.
Right.
I think it would have helped prior to 2016, but I hold our paper responsible for that as well. There's just a lot more of that kind of analysis going on after the fact. Let's look at the president's State of the Union address. Let's look at what was true, where they are in these meters. And there's a lot more websites available now, PolitiFact, ProPublica, that offer opportunities for go and do some fact checking on these kinds of things. So I do think it's incumbent on reporters to be upfront as to whether something is not true or not, and be upfront about that.
Right. Right. So this issue of misinformation, again, is one of the biggest issues that I think all journalists are having to deal with. So I'm going to play a clip here. This became a real issue in January 2017, right after the administration took power. So NPR, just a little background, NPR in the past, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, probably really in the past 2 years, has moved much more towards a format of live interviews. So it used to be, if you're listeners, you used to hear many more taped interviews. You would hear many more reported pieces. The newsroom leadership feels that it's important to hear people, to have interviews with newsmakers, and that the news cycle is changing so fast, things are happening overnight so quickly, that the only way to really stay on top of the news and be timely is with a live interview. It's very controversial in the newsroom. I've written a couple columns about this because there are challenges to doing live interviews. One of those big challenges is trying to catch it when somebody steps in with something that is wrong.
It's really hard.
It's really hard. Yeah. So the hosts are prepped, but you're doing a live interview with someone who sort of has come either intentionally or unintentionally with misinformation. And so you as the host have to, sort of anticipate what they're going to say. And then if you hear something that's inaccurate, you have to catch it and you have to stop the person. And it's really, I have enormous sympathy for the hosts on the air because the live interview format is very, very difficult. So I'm going to play one that sort of went wrong. The clip is about a minute long. And this is Rachel Martin, and she's interviewing Sebastian Gorka, who at the time was a White House national security aide.
Yeah.
Right.
Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
President Trump and other members of the administration have repeatedly said the courts have no ability to review this matter. Yesterday, Stephen Miller said, and I'm quoting here, the judiciary is not supreme. What does that mean?
Well, it means that we have separation of powers in the United States, and it seems as if certain judges deny that and think they have the ultimate authority when it comes to national security. So you don't have to read anything more into statements like that. And the fact is that the judiciary or specific judges are making gross mistakes. Just last year in 2016, a Senate subcommittee said there have been 72 people from the seven countries listed on that executive order who have been convicted of terrorist offenses in the United States since September the 11th. So when a judge or when anybody says these seven countries pose no threat to America, they're just flatly wrong, and that's the problem.
So that was inaccurate information, misinformation. Now, that interview went out live sometime between the 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Eastern time hour. So Morning Edition is a two-hour show. The vast majority of interviews that you hear with newsmakers in that first 2 hours are live. So anyone who heard it on the air at that point got misinformation. Now, NPR also rebroadcasts all of its interviews. It's called a rollover. So from 7 to 9, from 9 to 11, and then out here, I guess, you know, from 11 to 1. Those interviews are rebroadcast. So someone did actually catch it at that point, and this is how they had to handle it.
To a report from the Center for Immigration Studies, which is a group that advocates for less immigration to the U.S. The Washington Post has fact-checked this report, and they found that while some of the 72 people on the list were convicted of providing material support to terrorists, it also included people who were convicted of passport or visa fraud, not terrorism-related offenses. They found that it earned a, quote, 3 Pinocchios rating out of a possible 4, which means the Post found there to be significant factual errors in that claim.
So if you were listening on the West Coast that day, you actually heard that fact check, which is great. The problem is that the people who are listening live didn't. So there was significant misinformation that was broadcast on the air. That's a challenge. I sort of advocated at the time that NPR needed to stop doing so many live interviews if they weren't able to catch it. I have enormous sympathy for the hosts who are in that difficult situation, but it's a problem, right? We're not in the business of putting out misinformation. So in the end, what they did was NPR has started putting the live interviews on, and then they save 45 seconds at the end of that live interview, and they have a staff reporter or someone else who's on the beat who, and they say, okay, so Carrie Johnson, what did you hear there? And then that reporter can either correct misinformation if there was something wrong, they can add more context, they can put it into the broader context of what that person was saying. So that, to me, is actually a pretty good solution, right? So you can let the person speak, they can speak in their own words. It takes a little bit of pressure off the host to kind of be on top of anything that anyone might say, but then you also have the correction that is made right in the moment. Anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there unless you have anything else to add.
Well, I just want to say it was evident for those who watched 60 Minutes last night. I think it was Leslie Stahl was interviewing the president, and it creates some very awkward situations where you're constantly challenging the interviewee on the facts. But again, this is new territory. We've never been in an environment where the use of these so-called alternative facts seem to be so prevalent, or at least the freedom to use them. And it just, that's another great tool. I have great respect for NPR's efforts to set the record straight. And I think they serve as a model for many, many publications and broadcast media in that way. So
thank you. stay there, or do you want to come up here?
I'd rather just sit right here if I could.
Okay, and I can play your clips when you want them.
Borrow this microphone?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Hello, I'm Alex Chadwick, a former reporter and producer at NPR, and now just a freelancer and general bum. And this is a story I'm going to tell you about the story and play some sound from it that I produced about 30 years ago in 1989 when a lot was changing. And this is the story of a revolution, one of these ongoing series of revolutions and disillusions of governments that happened throughout Eastern Europe. I had been sent to cover the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Berlin Wall. But I didn't get there for about a week after the wall was actually breached and these holes were knocked in it. And Germany began reuniting, which had seemed impossible for decades. But here it was going on. By the time I got to Berlin, the city was sort of hung over. I mean, they weren't celebrating in the streets anymore. They were just kind of trying to figure out who they were and what they were and what was going to happen next. And there were other reporters there, including from Rome, NPR's wonderful Silvia Poggioli, and her husband, Piero Benatazzi. Piero was a little older. He had written for La Repubblica, a great newspaper, for many years. And back in 1968, he had been in Prague, Czechoslovakia, when reformers in Prague were trying to step aside from the communist government that ran everything and were having a fair amount of success until the government said help and the Soviets sent in tanks and everything calmed down and went back to being what it had been. So Piero told me that the next place that was going to go after Berlin would be Czechoslovakia. And I called NPR and talked to them. And 2 days later, I was on a train to Prague. And this is how that story began.
I left Berlin by train on a Friday morning, the day after Thanksgiving. It was a six-hour journey across the border to Prague, time enough to read a little and prepare for a place I'd never seen before. The anti-communist revolt that had transformed Poland and Hungary and then East Germany was coming now to Czechoslovakia. There were demands that the Communist Party leader, Miloš Jakeš, give up power. Jakeš was the man who was directing those who'd run Czechoslovakia for more than 20 years, ever since the Soviet army had gone in to stop the reforms of Alexander Dubček back in 1968. A journalist friend who'd been in Prague back then offered some advice about people to go see, some of the old reformers who would still know things. But I would need an interpreter, he said, and so I decided to go to the university first to look for an English-speaking student. And that is how I met Natasha Dudinska. I just found her in the entryway of the School of Philosophy and Languages at Charles University. She was the first person there who spoke English and said she could go to work right away. It was already dark. We began walking several blocks to the apartment of one of the old reformers suggested by my friend. I asked if she knew of this man, and she said no, that she did not. She said much of the history of 1968 was kept secret. Now, she said, the students meant to change this.
So, and democracy is something very fragile because we were not brought up, my generation was not brought up in democracy. And we don't know to express ourselves because we were not allowed. I am 22 and all my childhood, all my young days, we were just pushed down. And we also don't know how to listen to each other. We want dialogue, we want discussion. But discussion means that at least two people are speaking. Both of them are speaking and listening to each other. And this we should learn, to listen to each other.
Normally, when you travel for the NPR foreign desk, everything is arranged in advance. You have a local fixer to meet you and serve as an interpreter. You have local currency.
you have a place to stay and probably people to meet, sources to interview. I had none of that. And I was far enough ahead of the story that there were virtually no other reporters there. Natasha and I learned that there was a meeting of the Central Committee up in a big building in the hills around Prague. We got a taxi to take us up and wait for us, and we got out and walked around. There were police or soldiers there, and they asked us to leave. And we got back in the cab and turned on the radio to get the news.
But when we got back to the cab, we turned on the radio and tuned around to get the news. And pretty soon a bulletin came on.
Yes, that's true. Jakesh and that's fantastic. Central Committee, exact words, gave their places or their seats to the disposal of somebody to take them. It's unbelievable. I don't believe it yet, even if I heard it. It's yes, it's incredible. I mean, all the Central Committee gave their places to the disposal of people to take them, leading by Jakesh. It's, well, maybe it's history, but maybe we should be so much excited because who will change? Who will come then? But still, I mean, čo na to vravíte? Tešíte sa, že?
Ja bych brečil.
He is crying. He wants to cry. He's really excited about it.
This is the driver of the taxi.
No, na Václavák.
We should go to the Wenceslas Square after.
Tak tam chcete
ísť? No, nie, no.
The cab driver wept with joy and took us to the square, Wenceslas Square, the site of huge demonstrations in the past week where hundreds of thousands of Czechoslovaks demanded change. Now thousands gathered in the square again. Jakesh, hated Jakesh, had quit, and other top communists had quit too. And not only were they gone, those who gathered in Wenceslas Square to celebrate their going were beginning to see that perhaps nobody really knew anymore what was possible. Anything might be. My interpreter, student activist, said it was too soon to celebrate. There was too much left to do. And then she jumped in the air with pleasure.
Champagne, you see champagne already. The Jaspers finished. Jaspers, you know, drones. Finished. And you hear the ringing of the keys. That means the last calling. That means the end, the finish. It's over. The last calling.
Natasha was not just excellent in English. She was also smart, energetic, and very persuasive. And always at the university, which is where the revolution in Czechoslovakia began. The students were demonstrating and protesting. They began a strike at the university and occupied buildings and classrooms. They formed a leadership committee and gave a role there to Natasha. I soon learned that she was one of the leaders of the strike, and I began to think about telling this story through her eyes. For the next 10 days, I stayed reporting in Prague, but I also began interviewing Natasha and taking notes about her past. Her parents had been loyal party members and remained so, but she had always followed her grandfather, who had turned against the party in the 1950s. I told NPR I thought I had a very good insight story into what had happened. Finally, toward the end of my time there, the students were assembling again to discuss what to do. They filled a large classroom with the leaders on a low platform down in front. They were exhausted, many of them were sick. And then this, which is how the piece concludes.
Do you think of yourself now, after everything that's happened, as a revolutionary?
Not. No.
Not yet?
I don't know, people say that this is a revolution or was, but our historians in faculty quarrel about it, if to name it a revolution or not. I was not thinking about it.
Well, how do you think of it then?
Well, a burst. I would call it, is this English word? Burst? Burst, yes, of dreams, of ideals. Hopes. Yeah.
I saw the most beautiful moment of this revolution, or burst, or whatever it is. It was in a big hall in the philosophy building where the huge group meetings took place. Everyone was going to vote again on whether to continue the strike. It was late in the afternoon. The light was already shrinking from the big windows and the patterned glass in the ceiling. A violinist and a pianist from the Czechoslovak National Philharmonic had come to play. They said they would play Dvorak's 100th sonata, which he wrote for his children. There were several hundred students there. They filled the long stepped rows of bench seats and writing places, and they stood in the aisles where there was room and crowded the balcony in the back, and they looked down to where the musicians stood near the low platform and lectern at the front. Each face grew still. Natasha Dudinska was at one end of a long desk where the strike committee sat on the platform. She was wearing the same thick-knit red cotton sweater and green flannel shirt and black pants that she'd had on for 3 days. Her dark, tangled hair was tied back with a piece of black lace she'd gotten somewhere. She looked pale and colorless, except for a yellowing bruise the size of a dime on her forehead. The music went on like a lullaby. And at last, Natasha folded her arms on the desktop and lowered her head. Her eyes closed for a moment and struggled back open and then closed again. This was the only time in the 10 days I knew her that she looked at peace. For a moment, I thought she might actually be sleeping, but then her small head began to move with the rhythms of Dvorak. This is Alex Chadwick.
In NPR stories, you're not allowed, for normal stories, you're not allowed to include music because it's cheating in some ways. It's giving a feeling to a piece. And if that feeling is going to be there in that piece, it has to be there either because you've recorded something that says it's there or because you can write about it. But in this case, all this happened exactly as I said it had, and it was okay to use Dvorak because it mattered to the people there and it mattered to that moment. And it's beautiful. So you can put something beautiful in a radio piece, that's good. So lessons for younger journalists, if you believe in something, stay with it. If the story is speaking to you, it will matter to the audience too. Also, you're in an organization. Make allies. People in the organization who believe you and believe in you. Organize and take notes. I returned to Washington on a Wednesday night, and I had this piece on the air the following Saturday morning on Scott Simon's show at more than 20 minutes. And it won the Overseas Press Club Award that year for best foreign reporting on radio. I was able to do that largely because I had extensive notes. I had already written the piece, I just had to find the elements in my notes. And 2 days was enough time to do that. So, Don't forget your most important recording device.
All right, Paul, help us knit some of these things together now.
Well, I just have a few things. I just want to say that was a beautiful story, and I think there's so much to learn from that moment with Natasha about how so many revolutions begin with bursts of hopes and ideals and dreams, and a blow against propaganda and misinformation. And that's really where, I mean, all trying times, we overcome them, and so many of those revolutions begin with good journalism, good communication, and I think that was an example of that. I just want to, a couple of points, just take us back to 1954. There was a relatively young reporter back then named Edward R. Murrow, who was taking on Senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, who was sort of trampling on constitutional rights in pursuit of communists. And he had what was now known as a Murrow moment when he said on his broadcast, "We cannot confuse dissent with disloyalty." He says, "There is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent." And he really challenged breaking that sound barrier of objectivity that existed in journalism at that time. He said, "There's no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities." And this was a burst, a breaking down of barriers that existed at the time. And he had a lot of criticism about for saying that, but that really revolutionized the coverage of McCarthy, really started turning the tide against him in so many different ways, and really challenged presumptions of journalism and how we cover certain things. And, you know, even 14 years later, Walter Cronkite got on in front of the American public and said, you know what, the Vietnam War, it's clear at this point, is going to end at best in a stalemate, and it's time we start negotiating and get out of Vietnam. And some people were horrified by that. But he clearly identified it as an opinion. But again, that was another breaking down of certain barriers. And but I think there are clear guidelines on objectivity, but there are also times when journalists need to challenge that objectivity in times when that require it. And I would submit that this is one of those times where we are not operating in. We are in a new realm, and this is not 20, 25 years ago. We're in a presidency that does like to promote the idea of alternative facts, and I would say there is no such thing as alternative facts. There are either things that are true or not. And yes, there is a fine line, and I dealt for years on opinion pages, and I understand the difference between opinion and fact, and we constantly will be battling that. That's an important struggle that we should have. But determining who had a bigger turnout, the inauguration, Obama, and Trump, is not an opinion, it's a fact. And I think there's good science to suggest that global warming is not opinion, it's a fact. And there are many things out there that we can no longer accept as opinion, but either they're facts or they're lies. And we need our journalists to be out there and the front lines and making distinction between the two. So I commend my colleagues here and all they've done in their careers. And I think these are hard discussions, but I think we need to keep them alive. Thank you.
Hello.
Okay. This seems to be on. Any questions? Yeah, Raleigh.
So I'm wondering if we're follow up with Paul saying if we might be living in a time where journalists are reviewing ethics and they may be changing. By example, August 15 or 16 this year, the Boston Globe led a nationwide call for journalists to defend themselves as not being the enemy of the people, and they became a very active voice out of I think over 300 newsrooms, and I don't recall that kind of activism in newsrooms like that. That seemed like a different time. Are we examining ethics and maybe changing them now?
And maybe if, Elizabeth, maybe you could be the first answer, because I believe NPR decided that day that they weren't going to, on their website or on their air, sort of say, oh, we stand with these newspapers.
Right. So NPR did not take part in that. I will say that the one, I think we talked earlier about sort of what you can't do as an NPR journalist that's prescribed by the Code of Ethics, and so you can't take part in political events, you can't express political opinions, etc. The one exception is you are allowed to express opinions about free press issues. So as an individual journalist, you can, so, you know, give money to the Committee to Protect Journalists, for example. But NPR did decide to abstain. You know, there is a debate in the newsroom about, you know, is it a war if one side decides not to fight? the administration can declare a war on the press. I like to think that the press needs to do, well, I only speak for myself, but I think NPR should stick to its reporting. I think, you know, strong reporting will, if you have strong ethical reporting, there's nothing wrong with defending your own reporting, but I don't think you necessarily have to get into a fight with someone. You can walk away from it, and you can just do, you know, a journalist's job is to report. So you keep reporting, you keep making sure that your reporting is ethical and strong and factual and all the other tenets of good journalism, but that's my own personal opinion.
I know my former newspaper, the Press Democrat, did take part in that, but I think the best editorials and commentary about on that day were not a pro and con about what Trump is saying in his administration or not, but more a revalidation, verification, reminders of the importance of the role of a free press in this democracy. So important it was put into our very First Amendment. And I think sometimes we take that for granted. And, you know, there's a lot of efforts right now. I know State Senator Bill Dodd has just put in a bill that's just the governor just signed encouraging greater media literacy in our schools. And part of that is an understanding of the role of a free press in our government. You know, the Fourth Estate is an important aspect.
Good. More questions, please. Yes, sir. Hold on, wait. Okay.
Well, I was wondering after that article about Zuckerberg and can the democracy withstand Zuckerberg's thing that was in the New Yorker a while back, a big long-winded article, and then the article in your paper, Paul, your old paper, this morning about disinformation. And I'm wondering if these kind of restrictions that journalists have is going to allow us to survive with the kind of disinformation money and people that are just spending millions, probably billions, to send disinformation all over the country. It's totally, I mean, you know, beyond comprehension almost.
Do you want to take that, Paul?
You want to go first? No. Go ahead.
No, you're referring to Facebook, right? So the role of the platforms, of course, in distributing the news that NPR and other reputable news organizations put out. You know, there is a frustration, I think, because so much of that is out of control of the newsrooms. That said, that's sort of a separate issue than what the newsroom does, I think. I don't disagree with you that I think it's a huge challenge for newsrooms today to sort of figure out how to control their own content and But that's a little bit separate. So the problem of sort of the platforms is not something that the NPR news is necessarily going to solve. So
I think there was a study out of Stanford, and I think we talked about this in our fake news class, about that showed the efforts Facebook is employing to control information and to flag fake news on the what's circulated. Is having an impact. It's significantly, but it's still, even I think the numbers have fallen from 200 million fake news shares on Facebook down to 70 million. That's good news, but we still got 70 million fake news stories that are circulated every month, and that's only expected to go up as we get closer to midterms and certainly the 2020 election. So, and again, I'm not sure there's a government resolution, a regulatory legislative solution to that issue, but there is a solution in how we what information we share, how we become a more discerning public, where we get our information from, where we choose, what are the sources that are credible and what are not.
Right. So. That's you had said earlier about a news literacy, a media literacy. I think that that is a huge issue today. That's one of the reasons why we do these kinds of events. It's surprising to me how little sort of people do understand actually about how our credible newsrooms operate. And so I think the more sort of we talk about how we do our business and the decisions that are behind it, that's all you can do is sort of chip away at this issue.
Perhaps, Elizabeth, one thing that's of interest to me is the idea of fact-checking. You know, it's different, of course, in a magazine world where you have a month or so to dig up every last fact. What does NPR do on a sort of a day-to-day basis when a report comes in terms of its fact-checking?
Right. So there are procedures in place. The reporters and the editors are responsible for, like any journalist, for checking their facts. I will say that this has been an issue at NPR recently. You can look at the columns I've written. So the standards editor, who really oversees these issues in the newsroom, put out a memo 4 months ago pointing out that there were 100 corrections on average per month on NPR content. Those corrections are listed at npr.org. Occasionally they are reported on air. I think they are not reported on air often enough. If you make the mistake on air, I think you ought to correct it on the air, but the newsroom has not been doing that lately. They do correct it at npr.org, which is the website. The standards editor wanted to get the number down to 50. He wanted to have the number of corrections by October. We are in October and the number hasn't changed. it's a problem.
Can I say that I think that's an example of the integrity of NPR? I think corrections boxes show that your objective is to set the record straight.
Right.
I've been in business a long time. I've yet to see a perfect edition of any newspaper. New York Times has corrections every day. And the effort is not whether or not you got it perfect every day. Are you going to set it right when you get it? What effort are you going to correct the record?
Right.
And I think corrections are a great way to establish your credibility more than challenge it.
I mean, Alex might be able to speak to this, but one of the challenges at NPR is it's a legacy radio operation, right? So now we've become much more of a digital online NPR.org operation. So if you misspell somebody's name wrong on the radio, no one knows, right? If
it's in I'm always script, jealous of that, by the way.
Exactly. You know, I have no idea how Nadia spells her name. Maybe you don't either. but that's not a problem. But then because NPR has started putting out a digital story, a digital version of many of the radio pieces, along with a transcript, suddenly these spellings are really, really important, and the sort of legacy radio journalists aren't always getting it right.
Always carry a notebook.
And write everything down.
Yes.
Maybe you can come train people at in the newsroom.
All right, we have time for a couple more questions. Adia?
I'm curious, a lot of organizations are using Twitter and Facebook now to release information. Do you feel like reporting information from Twitter or Facebook from organizations like CAL FIRE, state organizations, is just as valid as calling them on the phone and getting that information or reporting what they say in a press release?
Yes, I think sometimes they have information that goes out on social media. It's a great way to use that as a way to communicate, particularly when something initial is happening. For the fire coverage, for example, but you always want to follow up. You always want to dig deeper. You want to get a live person. You want more explanation because Twitter is a very short communication tool, and you know, social media in itself is a very limited form of communication. Although our president seems to enjoy it, you don't capture a lot of what comes from just the audio communication you can get out there. So I it's a great tip form, and I think it's going to become more common.
Elizabeth, I know NPR has led the way in using social media to connect with the audience and to gather information.
Right, right, absolutely. NPR's done some interesting reporting on using social media. So they've tweeted out sort of stories, you know, in threaded tweet form, which I think is good. I do have, in terms of a news gathering resource, I have pro and con. So we get a lot of complaints to the ombudsman's office talking about why does NPR cover the president's tweets? Because they're often inflammatory and they do contain misinformation at times. The response has been, and I think it's valid from my perspective, this is how the president chooses to communicate. NPR covers presidential statements. He has chosen to use Twitter as a forum, and therefore that's, you know, I get complaints saying, well, it didn't come on a White House, you know, letterhead. Well, this is how the president communicates, and I think you have to cover it. Where I have problems with some of the reporting is, for example, I think I wrote about this during the Las Vegas shooting. So there was a lot of information that was coming from Facebook pages of victims. So people were posting and saying, you know, my son or whatever was killed, et cetera. All of that information is not verified, right? You can't reach the family. I think the families are doing that in many instances because they don't want to deal with the onslaught of reporting, except that there's no way to verify it. So as reporters, you need to, you know, you don't just take something at face value when it's said. You go in and you try and verify, and you come up with multiple sources before you report something. I think there is a little bit of a rush at times to just grab that information from social media and report it as fact when it hasn't been fact-checked. So I think that's problematic in my... I think that's going to be a problem.
Draw a distinction between, you know, tweets from CAL FIRE official organizations versus other ones. We had that same issue with that fire, with the shooting in Vegas. We had a student here who was one of the victims, and I was the faculty advisor of the student newspaper, and they had a whole story written about how one of the victims was there, but I couldn't get it. We couldn't get it confirmed. Right. We continued to push back our press deadline until we could have it confirmed. We finally got it, and we went with the story, but much of it was based on social media, and I was very uncomfortable with it. But that speaks to the whole new realm we're in, because we were able to, and the family, you know, was okay with us, you know, using the photo and everything ultimately, but that is a new challenge. That's very raw information and not always very reliable. So
we're going to say a great big thank you to our guests today, and thank you.
Thank you.